standards for this. In the first place, no one finds it easy to live uncomplainingly and fearlessly with the thesis that human reality is constantly being made and unmade, and that anything like a stable essence is constantly under threat. Patriotism, extreme xenophobic nationalism, and downright unpleasant chauvinism are common responses to this fear. We all need some foundation on which to stand. The question is, how extreme and unchangeable is our formulation of what this foundation is? My position is that in the case of an essential Islam or Orient, these images are no more than images, and are upheld as such both by the community of the Muslim faithful and, the correspondence is significant, by the community of Orientalists. My objection to what I have called Orientalism is not that it is just the antiquarian study of Oriental languages, societies, and peoples, but that as a system of thought, Orientalism approaches a heterogeneous, dynamic, and complex human reality from an uncritically essentialist standpoint. This suggests both an enduring Oriental reality and an opposing but no less enduring Western essence, which observes the Orient from afar and from, so to speak, above. This false position hides historical change. Even more important, from my standpoint, it hides the interests of the Orientalist. Those, despite attempts to draw subtle distinctions between Orientalism as an innocent scholarly endeavor and Orientalism as an accomplice to empire, can never unilaterally be detached from the general imperial context that begins its modern global phase with Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798. I have in mind the striking contrast between the weaker and stronger party that is evident from the beginning of Europe's modern encounters with what it called the Orient. The studied solemnity and grandiose accents of Napoleon's Description de l'Égypte, its massive, serried volumes testifying to the systematic labors of an entire corps of savants backed by a modern army of colonial conquest, dwarfs the individual testimony of people like Abdelrahman al-Jabarti, who, in three separate volumes, describes the French invasion from the point of view of the invaded. One might say that the description is just a scientific, and therefore objective, account of Egypt in the early 19th century, but the presence of Jabarti, who is both unknown and ignored by Napoleon, suggests otherwise. Napoleon's is an objective account from the standpoint of someone powerful trying to hold Egypt within the French imperial orbit. Jabarti's is an account by someone who paid the price, was figuratively captured and vanquished. In other words, rather than remaining as inert documents that testify to an eternally opposed Occident and Orient, the Description and Jabarti's chronicles together constitute a historical experience, out of which others evolved and before which others existed. Studying the historical dynamics of this set of experiences is more demanding than sliding back into stereotypes like the conflict of East and West. That is one reason why Orientalism is mistakenly read as a surreptitiously anti-Western work, and, by an act of unwarranted and even willful retrospective endowment, this reading, like all readings based on a supposedly stable binary opposition, elevates the image of an innocent and aggrieved Islam. The second reason why the anti-essentialism of my arguments has proved hard to accept is political and urgently ideological. I had absolutely no way of knowing that, a year after the book was published, Iran would be the site of an extraordinarily far-reaching Islamic revolution, nor that the battle between Israel and the Palestinians would take such savage and protracted forms, from the 1982 invasion of Lebanon to the onset of the Intifada in late 1987. The end of the Cold War did not mute, much less terminate, the apparently unending conflict between East and West as represented by the Arabs and Islam on one side and the Christian West on the other. More recent, but no less acute, contests developed as a result of the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. The challenge to the status quo during the 1980s and 90s, made by Islamic groups in countries as diverse as Algeria, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, and the occupied territories, and the various American and European responses. The creation of Islamic brigades to fight the Russians from bases in Pakistan. The Gulf War, the continued support of Israel, and the emergence of Islam as a topic of alarmed, if not always precise and informed, journalism and scholarship. All this inflamed the sense of persecution felt by people forced on an almost daily basis to declare themselves to be either Westerners or Easterners. No one seemed to be free from the opposition between us and them, which resulted in a sense of reinforced, deepened, hardened identity that has not been particularly edifying. In such a turbulent context, Orientalism's fate was both fortunate and unfortunate. To those in the Arab and Islamic world who felt Western encroachment with anxiety and stress, it appeared to be the first book that gave a serious answer back to a West that had never actually listened to or forgiven the Oriental for being an Oriental at all. I recall one early Arabic review of the book that described its author as a champion of Arabism, a defender of the downtrodden and abused, whose mission was to engage Western authorities in a kind of epic and romantic mano-a-mano. Despite the exaggeration, it did convey some real sense of the West's enduring hostility, as felt by Arabs, and it also conveyed a response that many educated Arabs felt was appropriate. I will not deny that I was aware, when writing the book, of the subjective truth insinuated by Marx in the little sentence I quoted as one of the book's epigraphs. They cannot represent themselves. They must be represented. Which is that if you feel you have been denied the chance to speak your piece, you will try extremely hard to get that chance. For indeed, the subaltern can speak, as the history of liberation movements in the 20th century eloquently attests. But I never felt that I was perpetuating the hostility between two rival political and cultural monolithic blocks, whose construction I was describing and whose terrible effects I was trying to reduce. On the contrary, as I said earlier, the Orient versus Occident opposition was both misleading and highly undesirable, the less it was given credit for actually describing anything more than a fascinating history of interpretations and of contesting interests, the better. I am happy to record that many readers in Britain and America, as well as in English-speaking Africa, Asia, Australia, and the Caribbean, saw the book as stressing the actualities of what was later to be called multiculturalism, rather than xenophobia and aggressive, race-oriented nationalism. Nevertheless, Orientalism has been thought of rather more as a kind of testimonial to subaltern status, the wretched of the earth talking back, than a multicultural critique of power using knowledge to advance itself. Thus, as its author, I have been seen as playing an assigned role, that of a self-representing consciousness of what had formerly been suppressed and distorted in the learned texts of a discourse specifically designed to be read not by Orientals, but by other Westerners. This is an important point, and it adds to the sense of fixed identities battling across a permanent divide that my book quite specifically abjures, but which it paradoxically presupposes and depends on. None of the Orientalists I write about seems ever to have intended an Oriental as a reader. The discourse of Orientalism, its internal consistency, and its rigorous procedures were all designed for readers and consumers in the metropolitan West. This goes as much for people I genuinely admire, like Edward Lane and Gustave Flaubert, who were fascinated by Egypt, as it does for haughty colonial administrators like Lord Cromer, brilliant scholars like Ernest Renan, and baronial aristocrats like Arthur Balfour, all of whom condescended to and disliked the Orientals they either ruled or studied. I must confess to a certain pleasure in listening in, uninvited, to their various pronouncements and inter-Orientalist discussions, and an equal pleasure in making known my findings both to Europeans and non-Europeans. I have no doubt that this was made possible because I traversed the imperial East-West divide, entered into the life of the West, and yet retained some organic connection with the place from which I originally came. I would repeat that this is very much a procedure of crossing rather than maintaining barriers. I believe Orientalism as a book shows it, especially at moments when I speak of humanistic study as seeking ideally to go beyond coercive limitations on thought toward a non-dominative and non-essentialist type of learning. These considerations did, in fact, add to the pressures on my book to represent a sort of testament of wounds and a record of sufferings, the recital of which was felt as a long-overdue striking back at the West. I deplore so simple a characterization of a work that is, here I am not going to be falsely modest, quite nuanced and discriminating in what it says about different people, different periods, and different styles of Orientalism. Each of my analyses varies the picture, increases the difference and discriminations, separates authors and periods from each other, even though all pertain to Orientalism. To read my analyses of Chateaubriand and Flaubert, or of Burton and Lane, with exactly the same emphasis, deriving the same reductive message from the banal formula, an attack on Western civilization, is, I believe, to be both simplistic and wrong. But I also believe that it is entirely correct to read recent Orientalist authorities, such as the almost comically persistent Bernard Lewis, as the politically motivated and hostile witnesses that their suave accents and unconvincing displays of learning attempt to hide. Once again, then, we are back to the political and historical context of the book, which I do not pretend is irrelevant to its contents. One of the most generously perspicacious and intelligently discriminating statements of that conjuncture was laid out in a review by Bassem Musallam, MERIP, 1979. He begins by comparing my book with an earlier demystification of Orientalism by the Lebanese scholar Michael Rustam in 1895, Kitab al-Gharib fi al-Gharb, but then says that the main difference between us is that my book is about loss, whereas Rustam's is not. Rustam writes as a free man and a member of a free society, a Syrian, Arab by speech, citizen of a still independent Ottoman state. Unlike Michael Rustam, Edward Said has no generally accepted identity. His very people are in dispute. It is possible that Edward Said and his generation sometimes feel that they stand on nothing more solid than the remnants of the destroyed society of Michael Rustam's Syria, and on memory. Others in Asia and Africa have had their successes in this age of national liberation. Here, in painful contrast, there has been desperate resistance against overwhelming odds and, until now, defeat. It is not just any Arab who wrote this book, but one with a particular background and experience. Musallam correctly notes that an Algerian would not have written the same kind of generally pessimistic book, especially one like mine that does very little with the history of French relations with North Africa, Algeria most particularly. So while I would accept the overall impression that Orientalism is written out of an extremely concrete history of personal loss and national disintegration, only a few years before I wrote Orientalism, Golda Meir made her notorious and deeply Orientalist comment about there being no Palestinian people. I would also like to add that neither in this book nor in the two that immediately followed it, The Question of Palestine, 1980, and Covering Islam, 1981, did I want only to suggest a political program of restored identity and resurgent nationalism. There was, of course, an attempt in both of the later books to supply what was missing in Orientalism, namely a sense of what an alternative picture of parts of the Orient, Palestine, and Islam, respectively, might be from a personal point of view. But in all my works, I remained fundamentally critical of a gloating and uncritical nationalism. The picture of Islam that I represented was not one of assertive discourse and dogmatic orthodoxy, but was based instead on the idea that communities of interpretation exist within and outside the Islamic world, communicating with each other in a dialogue of equals. My view of Palestine, formulated originally in The Question of Palestine, remains the same today. I expressed all sorts of reservations about the insouciant nativism and militant militarism of the nationalist consensus. I suggested instead a critical look at the Arab environment, Palestinian history, and the Israeli realities, with the explicit conclusion that only a negotiated settlement between the two communities of suffering, Arab and Jewish, would provide respite from the unending war. I should mention in passing that although my book on Palestine was given a fine Hebrew translation in the early 1980s by Mifras, a small Israeli publishing house, it remains untranslated into Arabic to this day. Every Arabic publisher who was interested in the book wanted me to change or delete those sections that were openly critical of one or another Arab regime, including the PLO, a request that I have always refused to comply with. I regret to say that the Arabic reception of Orientalism, despite Kamal Aboud-Dib's remarkable translation, still managed to ignore that aspect of my book which diminished the nationalist fervor that some implied from my critique of Orientalism, which I associated with those drives to domination and control also to be found in imperialism. Aboud-Dib's painstaking translation was an almost total avoidance of Arabized Western expressions, technical words like discourse, simulacrum, paradigm, or code, were rendered from within the classical rhetoric of the Arab tradition. His idea was to place my work inside one fully formed tradition, as if it were addressing another from a perspective of cultural adequacy and equality. In this way, he reasoned, it was possible to show that just as one could advance an epistemological critique from within the Western tradition, so too could one do it from within the Arabic. Yet the sense of fraught confrontation between an often emotionally defined Arab world and an even more emotionally experienced Western world drowned out the fact that Orientalism was meant to be a study in critique, not an affirmation of warring and hopelessly antithetical identities. Moreover, the actuality I described in the book's last pages of one powerful discursive system maintaining hegemony over another was intended as the opening salvo in a debate that might stir Arab readers and critics to engage more determinedly with the system of Orientalism. I was either upbraided for not having paid closer attention to Marx. The passages on Marx's own Orientalism in my book were the most singled out by dogmatic critics in the Arab world and India, for instance, whose system of thought was claimed to have risen above his obvious prejudices. Or I was criticized for not appreciating the great achievements of Orientalism, the West, etc. As with defenses of Islam, recourse to Marxism or the West as a coherent total system seems to me to have been a case of using one orthodoxy to shoot down another. The difference between Arab and other responses to Orientalism is, I think, an accurate indication of how decades of loss, frustration, and the absence of democracy have affected intellectual and cultural life in the Arab region. I intended my book as part of a pre-existing current of thought whose purpose was to liberate intellectuals from the shackles of systems such as Orientalism. I wanted readers to make use of my work so they might then produce new studies of their own that would illuminate the historical experience of Arabs and others in a generous, enabling mode. That certainly happened in Europe, the United States, Australia, the Indian subcontinent, the Caribbean, Ireland, Latin America, and parts of Africa. the invigorated study of Africanist and Indological discourses, the analyses of subaltern history, the reconfiguration of post-colonial anthropology, political science, art history, literary criticism, musicology, in addition to the vast new developments in feminist and minority discourses, to all these, I am pleased and flattered that Orientalism often made a difference. That does not seem to have been the case, insofar as I can judge it, in the Arab world, where, partly because my work is correctly perceived as Eurocentric in its texts, and partly because, as Musallam says, the battle for cultural survival is too engrossing, books like mine are interpreted less usefully, productively speaking, and more as defensive gestures either for or against the West. Yet among American and British academics of a decidedly rigorous and unyielding stripe, Orientalism, and indeed all of my other work, has come in for disapproving attacks because of its residual humanism, its theoretical inconsistencies, its insufficient, perhaps even sentimental, treatment of agency. I am glad that it has. Orientalism is a partisan book, not a theoretical machine. No one has convincingly shown that individual effort is not at some profoundly unteachable level, both eccentric and, in Gerard Manley Hopkins' sense, original. This, despite the existence of systems of thought, discourses, and hegemonies, although none of them are in fact seamless, perfect, or inevitable. The interest I took in Orientalism as a cultural phenomenon, like the culture of imperialism I talk about in Culture and Imperialism, its 1993 sequel, derives from its variability and unpredictability, both qualities that give writers like Massignon and Burton their surprising force and even attractiveness. What I tried to preserve in what I analyzed of Orientalism was its combination of consistency and inconsistency, its play, so to speak, which can only be rendered by preserving for oneself as writer and critic the right to some emotional force, the right to be moved, angered, surprised, and even delighted. This is why, in the debate between Gayan Prakash on the one hand and Rosalind O'Hanlon and David Washbrook on the other, I think Prakash's more mobile post-structuralism has to be given its due. By the same token, the work of Homi Pabha, Gayatri Spivak, and Ashish Nandi, predicated on the sometimes dizzying subjective relationships engendered by colonialism, cannot be gainsaid for its contribution to our understanding of the humanistic traps laid by systems such as Orientalism. Let me conclude this survey of Orientalism's critical transmutations with a mention of the one group of people who were, not unexpectedly, the most exercised and vociferous in responding to my book, the Orientalists themselves. They were not my principal intended audience at all. I had in mind casting some light on their practices so as to make other humanists aware of one field's particular procedures and genealogy. The word Orientalism itself has been for too long confined to a professional specialty. What I tried to show was its application and existence in the general culture, in literature, ideology, and social as well as political attitudes. To speak of someone as an Oriental, as the Orientalists did, was not just to designate that person as someone whose language, geography, and history were the stuff of learned treatises. It also was often meant as a derogatory expression, signifying a lesser breed of human being. This is not to deny that for artists like Nerval and Segalen, the word Orient was wonderfully, ingeniously connected to exoticism, glamour, mystery, and promise. But it was also a sweeping historical generalization. In addition to these uses of the words Orient, Oriental, and Orientalism, the term Orientalist also came to represent the erudite, scholarly, mainly academic specialist in the languages and histories of the East. Yet, As the late Albert Hourani wrote me in March 1992, a few months before his untimely and much regretted death, due to the force of my argument, for which he said he could not reproach me, my book had the unfortunate effect of making it almost impossible to use the term Orientalism in a neutral sense, so much had it become a term of abuse. He concluded that he would have still liked to retain the word for use in describing a limited, rather dull, but valid discipline of scholarship. In his generally balanced 1979 review of Orientalism, Hourani formulated one of his objections by suggesting that while I singled out the exaggerations, racism, and hostility of much Orientalist writing, I neglected to mention its numerous scholarly and humanistic achievements. Names that he brought up included Marshall Hodgson, Claude Cohen, and André Raymond, all of whose accomplishments, along with the German authors who come up de rigueur, should be acknowledged as real contributors to human knowledge. This does not, however, conflict with what I say in Orientalism, with the difference that I do insist on the prevalence in the discourse itself of a structure of attitudes that cannot simply be waved away or discounted. Nowhere do I argue that Orientalism is evil or sloppy or uniformly the same in the work of each Orientalist, but I do say that the Guild of Orientalists has a specific history of complicity with imperial power, which it would be Panglossian to call irrelevant. So while I sympathize with Hourani's plea, I have serious doubts whether the notion of Orientalism, properly understood, can ever, in fact, be completely detached from its rather more complicated and not always flattering circumstances. I suppose that one can imagine at the limit that a specialist in Ottoman or Fatimid archives is an Orientalist in Hourani's sense, but we are still required to ask where, how, and with what supporting institutions and agencies such studies take place today. Many who wrote after my book appeared asked exactly those questions of even the most recondite and otherworldly scholars, with sometimes devastating results. Still, there has been one sustained attempt to mount an argument whose purport is that a critique of Orientalism, mine in particular, is both meaningless and somehow a violation of the very idea of disinterested scholarship. That attempt is made by Bernard Lewis, about whom I had devoted a few critical pages in my book. 15 years after Orientalism appeared, Lewis produced a series of essays, some of them collected in a book entitled Islam and the West, one of whose main sections is an attack on me, which he surrounds with chapters and other essays that mobilize a set of lax and characteristically Orientalist formulas. Muslims are enraged at modernity. Islam never made the separation between church and state, and so on and so on, all of them pronounced with an extreme level of generalization and with scarcely a mention of the differences between individual Muslims, between Muslim societies, or between Muslim traditions and eras. Since Lewis has, in a sense, appointed himself a spokesman for the Guild of Orientalists on which my critique was originally based, it may be worth spending a little more time on his procedures. His ideas are, alas, fairly current among his acolytes and imitators, whose job seems to be to alert Western consumers to the threat of an enraged, congenitally undemocratic and violent Islamic world. Lewis's verbosity scarcely conceals both the ideological underpinnings of his position and his extraordinary capacity for getting nearly everything wrong. Of course, these are familiar attributes of the Orientalist's breed, some of whom have at least had the courage to be honest in their active denigration of Islamic as well as other non-European peoples. Not Lewis. He proceeds by distorting the truth, by making false analogies, and by innuendo, methods to which he adds that veneer of omniscient, tranquil authority which he supposes is the way scholars talk. Take as a typical example the analogy he draws between my critique of Orientalism and a hypothetical attack on studies of classical antiquity, an attack which, he says, would be a foolish activity. It would be, of course, but then Orientalism and Hellenism are radically incomparable. The former is an attempt to describe a whole region of the world as an accompaniment to that region's colonial conquest. The latter is not at all about the direct colonial conquest of Greece in the 19th and 20th centuries. In addition, Orientalism expresses antipathy to Islam, Hellenism sympathy for classical Greece. Additionally, the present political moment, with its reams of racist anti-Arab and anti-Muslim stereotypes, and no attacks on classical Greece, allows Lewis to deliver ahistorical and willful political assertions in the form of scholarly argument, a practice thoroughly in keeping with the least creditable aspects of old-fashioned colonialist Orientalism. Lewis's work, therefore, is part of the present political rather than purely intellectual environment. To imply, as he does, that the branch of Orientalism dealing with Islam and the Arabs is a learned discipline that can therefore be compared with classical philology is as appropriate as comparing one of the many Israeli Arabists and Orientalists who have worked for the occupation authorities of the West Bank and Gaza with scholars like Vilamovitz or Mommsen. On the one hand, Lewis wishes to reduce Islamic Orientalism to the status of an innocent and enthusiastic department of scholarship. On the other, he wishes to pretend that Orientalism is too complex, various, and technical to exist in a form for any non-Orientalist, like myself and many others, to criticize. Lewis's tactic here is to suppress a significant amount of history. As I suggest, European interest in Islam derived not from curiosity, but from fear of a monotheistic, culturally and militarily formidable competitor to Christianity. The earliest European scholars of Islam, as numerous historians have shown, were medieval polemicists writing to ward off the threat of Muslim hordes and apostasy. In one way or another, that combination of fear and hostility has persisted to the present day, both in scholarly and non-scholarly attention to an Islam which is viewed as belonging to a part of the world, the Orient, counterposed imaginatively, geographically, and historically against Europe and the West. The most interesting problems about Islamic or Arabic Orientalism are, first, the forms taken by the medieval vestiges that persist so tenaciously, and second, the history and sociology of connections between Orientalism and the societies that produced it. There are strong affiliations between Orientalism and the literary imagination, for example, as well as the imperial consciousness. What is striking about many periods of European history is the traffic between what scholars and specialists wrote and what poets, novelists, politicians, and journalists then said about Islam. In addition, and this is the crucial point that Lewis refuses to deal with, there is a remarkable, but nonetheless intelligible, parallel between the rise of modern Orientalist scholarship and the acquisition of vast Eastern empires by Britain and France. Although the connection between a routine British classical education and the extension of the British Empire is more complex than Lewis might suppose, no more glaring parallel exists between power and knowledge in the modern history of philology than in the case of Orientalism. Much of the information and knowledge about Islam and the Orient that was used by the colonial powers to justify their colonialism derived from Orientalist scholarship. A recent study by many contributors, Orientalism and the Post-Colonial Predicament, edited by Carl A. Breckenridge and Peter Vanderveer, demonstrates with copious documentation how Orientalist knowledge was used in the colonial administration of South Asia. A fairly consistent interchange still continues between area scholars, such as Orientalists, and government departments of foreign affairs. In addition, many of the stereotypes of Islamic and Arabic sensuality, sloth, fatalism, cruelty, degradation, and splendor to be found in writers from John Buchan to V.S. Naipaul have also been presuppositions underlying the adjoining field of academic Orientalism. In contrast, the trade in clichés between Indology and Sinology on the one hand and general culture on the other is not quite as flourishing, although there are relationships and borrowings to be noted. Nor is there much similarity between what obtains among Western experts in Sinology and Indology, and the fact that many professional scholars of Islam in Europe and the United States spend their lives studying the subject, yet still find it an impossible religion and culture to like, much less admire. To say, as Lewis and his imitators do, that all such observations are only a matter of espousing fashionable causes, is not quite to address the question of why, for example, so many Islamic specialists were and still are routinely consulted by and actively work for governments whose designs in the Islamic world are economic exploitation, domination, or outright aggression, or why so many scholars of Islam, like Lewis himself, voluntarily feel that it is part of their duty to mount attacks on modern Arab or Islamic peoples with the pretense that classical Islamic culture can nevertheless be the object of disinterested scholarly concern. The spectacle of specialists in the history of medieval Islamic guilds being sent on State Department missions to brief area embassies on United States security interests in the Persian Gulf does not spontaneously suggest anything resembling the love of Hellas ascribed by Lewis to the supposedly cognate field of classical philology. It is therefore not surprising that the field of Islamic and Arabic Orientalism, always ready to deny its complicity with state power, had never, until very recently, produced an internal critique of the affiliations I have just been describing, and that Lewis can utter the amazing statement that a criticism of Orientalism would be meaningless. It is also not surprising that, with a few exceptions, most of the negative criticism my work has elicited from specialists has been, like Lewis's, no more than banal description of a barony violated by a crude trespasser. The only specialists, again with a few exceptions, who attempted to deal with what I discuss, which is not only the content of Orientalism, but its relationships, affiliations, political tendencies, and worldview, were Sinologists, Indologists, and the younger generation of Middle East scholars, susceptible to newer influences and also to the political arguments that the critique of Orientalism entailed. One example is Benjamin Schwartz of Harvard, who used the occasion of his 1982 presidential address to the Asian Studies Association not only to disagree with some of my criticism, but also to welcome my arguments intellectually. Many of the senior Arabists and Islamicists have responded with the aggrieved outrage that is for them a substitute for self-reflection. Most use words such as malign, dishonor, libel, as if criticism itself were an impermissible violation of their sacrosanct academic preserve. In Lewis's case, the defense offered is an act of conspicuous bad faith, since more than most Orientalists, he has been a passionate political partisan against Arab and other causes in such places as the U.S. Congress, Commentary, and elsewhere. The proper response to him must therefore include an account of what politically and sociologically he is all about when he pretends to be defending the honor of his field, a defense which, it will be evident enough, is an elaborate confection of ideological half-truths designed to mislead non-specialist readers. In short, the relationship between Islamic or Arab Orientalism and modern European culture can be studied without at the same time cataloging every Orientalist who ever lived, every Orientalist tradition, or everything written by Orientalists, then lumping them together as rotten and worthless imperialism. I never did that anyway. It is benighted to say that Orientalism is a conspiracy or to suggest that the West is evil. Both are among the egregious fatuities that Lewis and one of his epigones, the Iraqi publicist K. Makia, have had the temerity to ascribe to me. On the other hand, it is hypocritical to suppress the cultural, political, ideological, and institutional contexts in which people write, think, and talk about the Orient, whether they are scholars or not. And as I said earlier, it is extremely important to understand that the reason Orientalism is opposed by so many thoughtful non-Westerners is that its modern discourse is correctly perceived as a discourse of power, originating in an era of colonialism, the subject of an excellent recent symposium, Colonialism and Culture, edited by Nicholas B. Dirks. In this kind of discourse, based mainly upon the assumption that Islam is monolithic and unchanging, and therefore marketable by experts for powerful domestic political interests, neither Muslims nor Arabs nor any of the other dehumanized lesser peoples recognize themselves as human beings or their observers as simple scholars. Most of all, they see in the discourse of modern Orientalism and its counterparts in similar knowledges constructed for Native Americans and Africans a chronic tendency to deny, suppress, or distort the cultural context of such systems of thought in order to maintain the fiction of its scholarly disinterest. 2. Yet I would not want to suggest that, current though such views as Lewis's may be, they are the only ones that have either emerged or been reinforced during the past decade and a half. Yes, it is true that ever since the demise of the Soviet Union, there has been a rush by some scholars and journalists in the United States to find in an Orientalized Islam a new empire of evil. Consequently, both the electronic and print media have been awash with demeaning stereotypes that lump together Islam and terrorism, or Arabs and violence, or the Orient and tyranny. And there has also been a return in various parts of the Middle and Far East to nativist religion and primitive nationalism, one particularly disgraceful aspect of which is the continuing Iranian fatwa against Salman Rushdie. But this isn't the whole picture, and what I want to do in the remaining part of this essay is to talk about new trends in scholarship, criticism, and interpretation that, although they accept the basic premises of my book, go well beyond it in ways, I think, that enrich our sense of the complexity of historical experience. None of those trends has emerged out of the blue, of course, nor have they gained the status of fully established knowledges and practices. The worldly context remains both perplexingly stirred up and ideologically fraught, volatile, tense, changeable, and even murderous. Even though the Soviet Union has been dismembered and the Eastern European countries have attained political independence, patterns of power and dominance remain unsettlingly in evidence. The Global South, once referred to romantically and even emotionally as the Third World, is enmeshed in a debt trap, broken into dozens of fractured or incoherent entities, beset with problems of poverty, disease, and underdevelopment that have increased in the past 10 or 15 years. Gone are the non-aligned movement and the charismatic leaders who undertook decolonization and independence. An alarming pattern of ethnic conflict and local wars, not confined to the Global South, as the tragic case of the Bosnians attests, has sprung up all over again. And in places like Central America, the Middle East, and Asia, the United States still remains the dominant power, with an anxious and still ununified Europe straggling behind. Explanations for the current world scene and attempts to comprehend it culturally and politically have emerged in some strikingly dramatic ways. I have already mentioned fundamentalism. The secular equivalents are a return to nationalism and theories that stress the radical distinction, a falsely all-inclusive one, I believe, between different cultures and civilizations. Recently, for example, Professor Samuel Huntington of Harvard University advanced the far-from-convincing proposition that Cold War bipolarism has been superseded by what he called the clash of civilizations, a thesis based on the premise that Western, Confucian, and Islamic civilizations, among several others, were rather like watertight compartments whose adherents were at bottom mainly interested in fending off all the others. This is preposterous, since one of the great advances in modern cultural theory is the realization, almost universally acknowledged, that cultures are hybrid and heterogeneous, and, as I argued in Culture and Imperialism, that cultures and civilizations are so interrelated and interdependent as to beggar any unitary or simply delineated description of their individuality. How can one today speak of Western civilization except as in large measure an ideological fiction, implying a sort of detached superiority for a handful of values and ideas, none of which has much meaning outside the history of conquest, immigration, travel, and the mingling of peoples that gave the Western nations their present mixed identities. This is especially true of the United States, which today cannot seriously be described except as an enormous palimpsest of different races and cultures sharing a problematic history of conquests, exterminations, and of course major cultural and political achievements. And this was one of the implied messages of Orientalism, that any attempt to force cultures and peoples into separate and distinct breeds or essences exposes not only the misrepresentations and falsifications that ensue, but also the way in which understanding is complicit with the power to produce such things as the Orient or the West. Not that Huntington, and behind him all the theorists and apologists of an exultant Western tradition like Francis Fukuyama, haven't retained a good deal of their hold on the public consciousness. They have, as is evident in the symptomatic case of Paul Johnson, once a left intellectual, now a retrograde social and political polemicist. In the April 18, 1993 issue of the New York Times Magazine, by no means a marginal publication, Johnson published an essay entitled "Colonialism's Back, and Not a Moment Too Soon," whose main idea was that the civilized nations ought to take it upon themselves to recolonize third world countries, where the most basic conditions of civilized life had broken down, and to do this by means of a system of imposed trusteeships. His model is explicitly a 19th century colonial one, where, he says, in order for the Europeans to trade profitably, they had to impose political order. Johnson's argument has numerous subterranean echoes in the works of U.S. policymakers, the media, and of course U.S. foreign policy itself, which remains interventionist in the Middle East, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, and frankly missionary everywhere else, especially with regard to its policies toward Russia and the former Soviet republics. The important point, however, is that a largely unexamined but serious rift has opened in the public consciousness between the old ideas of Western hegemony, of which the system of Orientalism was a part, on the one hand, and newer ideas that have taken hold among subaltern and disadvantaged communities and among a wide sector of intellectuals, academics, and artists, on the other. It is now, very strikingly, no longer the case that the lesser peoples, formerly colonized, enslaved, suppressed, are silent or unaccounted for except by senior European or American males. There has been a revolution in the consciousness of women, minorities, and marginals so powerful as to affect mainstream thinking worldwide. Although I had some sense of it when I was working on Orientalism in the 1970s, It is now so dramatically apparent as to demand the attention of everyone seriously concerned with the scholarly and theoretical study of culture. Two broad currents can be distinguished, post-colonialism and post-modernism, both, in their use of the word post, suggesting not so much the sense of going beyond, but rather, as Ella Shohat puts it in a seminal article on the post-colonial, suggesting continuities and discontinuities, but its emphasis is on the new modes and forms of the old colonialist practices, not on a beyond. Both post-colonialism and post-modernism emerged as related topics of engagement and investigation during the 1980s, and in many instances seemed to take account of such works as Orientalism as antecedents. It would be impossible here to get into the immense terminological debates that surround both words, some of them dwelling at length on whether the phrases should or should not be hyphenated. The point here is, therefore, not to talk about isolated instances of excess or risible jargon, but to locate those currents and efforts which, from the perspective of a book published in 1978, seem to some extent now to involve it in 1994. Much of the most compelling work on the new political and economic order has concerned what, in a recent article, Harry Magdoff has described as globalization, a system by which a small financial elite expanded its power over the whole globe, inflating commodity and service prices, redistributing wealth from lower income sectors, usually in the non-Western world, to the higher income ones. Along with this, as discussed in astringent terms by Masao Miyoshi and Arif Dirlik, there has emerged a new transnational order in which states no longer have borders, labor and income are subject only to global managers, and colonialism has reappeared in the subservience of the South to the North. Both Miyoshi and Dirlik go on to show how the interest of Western academics in subjects such as multiculturalism and post-coloniality can in fact be a cultural and intellectual retreat from the new realities of global power. What we need, Miyoshi says, is a rigorous political and economic scrutiny rather than a gesture of pedagogic expediency, exemplified by the liberal self-deception contained in such new fields as cultural studies and multiculturalism. But even if we take such injunctions seriously, as we must, there is a solid basis in historical experience for the appearance today of interest in both postmodernism and its quite different counterpart, post-colonialism. There is, first of all, the much greater Eurocentric bias in the former, and a preponderance of theoretical and aesthetic emphasis stressing the local and the contingent, as well as the almost decorative weightlessness of history, pastiche, and above all, consumerism. The earliest studies of the post-colonial were by such distinguished thinkers as Anwar Abdelmelek, Samir Amin, and C.L.R. James, almost all based on studies of domination and control done from the standpoint of either a completed political independence or an incomplete liberationist project. Yet whereas postmodernism, in one of its most famous programmatic statements, Jean-François Lyotard's, stresses the disappearance of the grand narratives of emancipation and enlightenment, the emphasis behind much of the work done by the first generation of post-colonial artists and scholars is exactly the opposite. The grand narratives remain, even though their implementation and realization are at present in abeyance, deferred, or circumvented. This crucial difference between the urgent historical and political imperatives of post-colonialism and post-modernism's relative detachment makes for altogether different approaches and results, although some overlap between them, in the technique of magical realism, for example, does exist. I think it would be wrong to suggest that in much of the best post-colonial work that has proliferated so dramatically since the early 1980s, there hasn't been a great emphasis on the local, regional, and contingent. There has, but it seems to me to be most interestingly connected in its general approach to a universal set of concerns, all of them having to do with emancipation, revisionist attitudes toward history and culture, and a widespread use of recurring theoretical models and styles. A leading motif has been the consistent critique of Eurocentrism and patriarchy. Across U.S. and European campuses in the 1980s, students and faculty alike worked assiduously to expand the academic focus of so-called core curricula to include writing by women, non-European artists and thinkers, and subalterns. This was accompanied by important changes in the approach to area studies, long in the hands of classical Orientalists and their equivalents. Anthropology, political science, literature, sociology, and above all history, felt the effects of a wide-ranging critique of sources, the introduction of theory, and the dislodgement of the Eurocentric perspective. Perhaps the most brilliant revisionist work was done not in Middle East studies, but in the field of Indology, with the advent of subaltern studies, a group of remarkable scholars and researchers led by Ranajit Guha. Their aim was nothing less than a revolution in historiography, their immediate goal being to rescue the writing of Indian history from the domination of the nationalist elite and restore to it the important role of the urban poor and the rural masses. I think it would be wrong to say of such mostly academic work only that it was easily co-optable and complicit with transnational neocolonialism. We need to record and acknowledge the achievement while warning of the later pitfalls. What has been of special interest for me has been the extension of post-colonial concerns to the problems of geography. After all, Orientalism is a study based on the rethinking of what had for centuries been believed to be an unbridgeable chasm separating East from West. My aim, as I said earlier, was not so much to dissipate difference itself, for who can deny the constitutive role of national as well as cultural differences in the relations between human beings, but to challenge the notion that difference implies hostility, a frozen, reified set of opposed essences, and a whole adversarial knowledge built out of those things. What I called for in Orientalism was a new way of conceiving the separations and conflicts that had stimulated generations of hostility, war, and imperial control. And indeed, one of the most interesting developments in post-colonial studies was a rereading of the canonical cultural works, not to demote or somehow dish dirt on them, but to reinvestigate some of their assumptions, going beyond the stifling hold on them of some version of the master-slave binary dialectic. This has certainly been the comparable effect of astoundingly resourceful novels such as Rushdie's Midnight's Children, the narratives of C.L.R. James, the poetry of Aimé Césaire and of Derek Walcott, works whose daring new formal achievements are, in effect, a reappropriation of the historical experience of colonialism, revitalized and transformed into a new aesthetic of sharing and often transcendent reformulation. One sees it also in the work of the group of distinguished Irish writers who in 1980 established themselves as a collective called Field Day. The preface to a collection of their works says about them, "These writers believed that Field Day could and should contribute to the solution of the present crisis by producing analyses of the established opinion, myths and stereotypes which had become both a symptom and cause of the current situation between Ireland and the North. The collapse of constitutional and political arrangements and the recrudescence of the violence which they had been designed to repress or contain made this a more urgent requirement in the North than in the Republic. The company, therefore, decided to embark upon a succession of publications, starting with a series of pamphlets, in addition to an impressive series of poems by Seamus Heaney, essays by Seamus Dean, plays by Brian Friel and Tom Paulin. in which the nature of the Irish problem could be explored, and as a result, more successfully confronted than it had been hitherto. The idea of rethinking and reformulating historical experiences which had once been based on the geographical separation of peoples and cultures is at the heart of a whole spate of scholarly and critical works. It is to be found, to mention only three,